All right, so get this. Imagine having the audacity to actually sue the President of the United States.
Oh, wow.
That's exactly what happened. Back in 1867, with the case of Mississippi v. Johnson,
Yeah.
talk about a power move, right? We're going to be diving deep into this historical showdown today,
Yeah.
to uncover how it shaped our understanding of presidential power and its limits.
It's a fascinating case, especially considering the context. So the Civil War had just ended, and the nation was grappling with this whole idea of Reconstruction. Congress was trying to figure out, how to rebuild the South and integrate these formerly Confederate states back into the Union.
Oh, yeah.
And they were using these things called the Reconstruction Acts to kind of push for these big changes, civil rights, a new order, the whole nine yards.
Right, smack dab in the middle of this, massive societal shift. You've got President Andrew Johnson, who was, shall we say, not thrilled about all these changes,
Not a fan.
vetoes flying left and right.
Yeah, it was a political standoff for sure, of epic proportions.
And this is where the state of Mississippi throws its hat in the ring.
They were furious about these Reconstruction Acts.
Yeah.
They saw them as a direct attack on their state sovereignty.
Wow.
So they decided to pull out the big guns
Okay.
and sue President Johnson himself.
Okay, time out. Suing the president. Was that even like a thing back then? Can you
No.
imagine? I mean, the legal chaos that could unleash if anyone could just like haul the president into court.
Well, that was the million-dollar question that the Supreme Court had to wrestle with. Like, could they actually issue what's called an injunction against the president, basically a legal cease and desist to stop him from doing his job? It was a case that really struck at the very heart of the balance of power in our government.
I bet that raised some eyebrows in Washington.
Definitely.
So what was Mississippi's argument? Like, what made them think they had a chance of actually winning this thing?
Their argument really hinged on the idea that President Johnson's duty to enforce these Reconstruction Acts was purely what they called ministerial. They were trying to say it was just a simple, straightforward task, like a clerk just stamping a document, not something that really requires executive decision making, right?
So their logic was, since enforcing these acts was like just a routine task, the court could step in and just tell him to stop. Kind of like, hey, Mr. President, put down that stamp.
You got it. But of course, it wasn't that simple. The Supreme Court had to determine whether this ministerial versus discretionary distinction actually held water,
Yeah.
in this case. And ultimately, they didn't buy it.
So the court basically said, hold on, Mississippi, enforcing these acts is a little more complicated than just rubber stamping them.
Exactly. They saw it as something that required complex judgments
Right.
and navigating some serious political minefields. It wasn't something that they felt comfortable kind of dictating to the president.
Yeah, I could see how that could lead to, a real power struggle between, branches of government. Did the court address that concern at all?
Absolutely. They were very aware of the potential for conflict if they tried to, micromanage the president's every move. They even used some pretty strong language. They described the possibility of a dangerous conflict between the judiciary, the courts, and the executive branch, the president.
It sounds like they were trying to walk a very fine line.
They were. They wanted to uphold this idea of checks and balances, but
Right.
without stepping on the toes of the president.
Now, I'm guessing Mississippi had a little backup plan, right? They weren't just going to give up that
Oh,
easily.
they're crafty.
Yeah.
So they tried this clever little legal maneuver. Instead of just suing Johnson as the president, they also tried to sue him as a private citizen, hoping that that might give them a little workaround.
Sneaky.
Yeah?
Did it work?
Not a chance. The court saw right through that. They pointed out that what Mississippi wanted, which was to stop the enforcement of the acts, clearly targeted Johnson in his official role as president, not anything to do with his private life.
So the court was basically like, nice try, but we're not falling for that technicality.
Exactly. They weren't going to let Mississippi just blur the lines between the president's public duties and his private life in
Right?
this context.
Yeah.
It was a clear message that they understood and wanted to respect the office of the presidency.
Okay, so enough with the legal maneuvering. What was the final verdict? Did the Supreme Court side with President Johnson or with Mississippi?
Ultimately, they sided with President Johnson.
Okay.
They ruled that the president can't be sued to prevent him from carrying out his official duties, even if those duties involve actions that might be considered unconstitutional.
Wait a minute. So they dodged the whole question of whether the Reconstruction Acts were constitutional or not.
That's the crucial part. The court made it very clear that their decision was not about the validity of the Reconstruction Acts themselves.
Oh.
Their ruling was solely focused on whether the judiciary, meaning themselves, themselves had the authority to interfere with the president's actions in this very specific way.
So they basically said, look, we're not going to get into the weeds of whether these acts are constitutional or not. We're here to decide if we can tell the president what to do, and the answer is no.
You nailed it. They were very careful to stay within their lane, address the very narrow legal question in front of them, which was this issue of judicial power versus executive authority.
Okay, this is starting to make sense. So the court said no to blocking Johnson, but didn't actually say the Reconstruction Acts were okay. But did they leave any room for future legal challenges to these acts?
Here's where it gets interesting. While the court sided with President Johnson, they didn't give him a blank check. They emphasized that their decision didn't prevent future challenges to laws after they were put into practice.
You mean like if someone's rights were violated because of these acts, they could take legal action?
Exactly. The court made a clear distinction between blocking the president from doing his job and allowing legal challenges based on the results of his actions. They were essentially saying, we're not going to micromanage the president, but we're also not going to completely surrender our power of judicial review.
All right. So the delicate balancing act, they're saying, Mr. President, you're free to do your thing, but we're keeping an eye on you.
That's a great way to put it.
It all boils down to the fundamental principle of checks and balances within our system of government. They basically said, we trust you to exercise your executive authority responsibly. But if your actions infringe on someone's rights down the line, we're stepping in.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this seemingly obscure case from 1867 is actually really important. And I think our listeners could use a moment to process all this. We'll pick this back up in just a second.
You know, it's fascinating to think how different things might have been if Mississippi had waited to challenge the Reconstruction Acts until after they were implemented and someone's rights were actually affected.
Right. It's like they kind of jumped the gun by trying to stop President Johnson before anything had even happened. So let's say, hypothetically, that someone's rights were violated as a result of these acts.
Right.
Could they have then taken legal action?
That's the distinction the court made. They kind of shielded the president from being sued preemptively.
Right.
But they explicitly acknowledged that legal challenges could arise from the consequences of his actions. So it's all about timing and waiting for those consequences to actually occur.
So they were basically saying, we'll deal with the fallout if and when it happens.
Exactly. They were really emphasizing the importance of waiting for a very concrete issue to arise before intervening. They didn't want to get all bogged down in hypothetical situations or kind of limit the president's ability to act based on what ifs.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It seems like this whole idea of waiting for actual harm to occur before jumping in is pretty relevant to modern debates about presidential power. Especially when you think about things like executive orders or controversial policies.
Absolutely, you're right. The legacy of Mississippi v. Johnson is very much alive today.
Yeah.
Think about recent challenges to immigration policies or environmental regulations.
Right.
A lot of these cases often hinge on the same basic principle that was established back in 1867. The courts are hesitant to interfere with presidential actions until there's like a really clear demonstration of harm.
So even though this case was about a very specific set of circumstances, you know, during Reconstruction, the legal principles established in that case have this ripple effect that extends to how we approach presidential power even now.
Precisely. It's really a cornerstone of our understanding of the separation of powers.
Yeah.
And that delicate balance between respecting executive authority while still ensuring accountability.
It's amazing how a case from so long ago can still be so relevant.
What's particularly interesting is that Mississippi v. Johnson actually laid the groundwork for future cases that further refined the limits of executive power. The famous Youngstown Sheet and Tube case from 1952 actually built upon these principles, offering a more nuanced framework for analyzing presidential actions.
Okay, for our listeners who might not be familiar with that case, can you give us the SparkNotes version of how Youngstown Sheet and Tube connected to Mississippi v. Johnson?
Sure. So in Youngstown Sheet and Tube, the Supreme Court was dealing with President Truman's decision to seize steel mills during the Korean War.
Okay.
And the court ultimately ruled against the president.
Wow.
But they actually used the framework that was established in Mississippi v. Johnson to analyze the scope of his authority. So they acknowledged this need to respect presidential power, but also emphasized the importance of congressional authorization for certain actions.
So it's like Mississippi v. Johnson was the foundation, and Youngstown Sheet and Tube built upon it to create a more sophisticated understanding of when the president can kind of act on his own and when he needs Congress's blessing.
That's a great way to think about it. These cases taken together illustrate how our legal system's approach to executive power is constantly evolving.
And how does this all relate to lawyers and law students today? What can they learn from Mississippi v. Johnson?
Well, I think on a practical level, it teaches us to be strategic. So if you're trying to challenge a presidential action, it's usually more effective to go after cabinet officials or agency heads who might be carrying out these, you know, quote unquote, ministerial duties, rather than the president himself, who enjoys a significant degree of immunity.
Right.
So remember, the court in Mississippi v. Johnson said the president can't be sued to stop him from carrying out his duties.
So it's all about choosing your battles wisely and understanding the nuances of how executive power actually works.
Exactly. Mississippi v. Johnson provides a really valuable lesson in legal strategy, especially when it comes to these types of challenges.
This is all incredibly insightful. I'm starting to see how these seemingly historical legal cases can actually be really relevant for lawyers navigating, you know, today's complex legal landscape.
They absolutely are. They provide the foundation for understanding our system of government and how the different branches interact with one another.
Before we wrap up, there's one more thing I want to clear up. I think there's this common misconception about Mississippi v. Johnson.
Okay.
People often assume that the court actually ruled on the constitutionality of the Reconstruction Acts.
Right.
But that's not quite right, is it?
You're right. That's a really important point. The court never actually said whether those acts were constitutional or not.
Right.
They very specifically sidestepped that issue.
So their silence on that doesn't mean they gave those acts a thumbs up.
Right.
It just means that wasn't the question they were tasked with answering.
Exactly. It's a reminder that court cases often have very specific and limited scopes. And in Mississippi v. Johnson, the court was laser focused on this issue of judicial power and executive immunity, not the constitutionality of the Reconstruction Acts themselves.
I think that's a really crucial distinction for our listeners to grasp. Don't read into a court's silence. Focus on the specific legal questions they address.
You've hit the nail on the head. Understanding the limits of a court's ruling is crucial for accurately interpreting legal precedent and applying it to other situations.
Okay, I'm ready to bring this all together. We've explored the historical context of Mississippi v. Johnson, delved into the legal arguments, and discussed its lasting impact on how we view executive power.
It's truly a case that continues to shape legal debates about the balance of power in our government. It offers valuable insights into this delicate dance between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches.
I think our listeners will walk away from this deep dive with a much richer understanding of this pivotal case and how it applies to issues we're facing today.
I agree. It's a reminder that even cases from over 150 years ago can still have a really profound impact on how we understand and interpret the law in the present day.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Mississippi v. Johnson, what are the big picture takeaways our listeners should remember?
I think one of the big takeaways is that it established this really clear boundary between the judiciary and the executive branch. The court basically said, look, we're not going to interfere with the president's ability to do his job, you know, to carry out those constitutional duties.
Right.
Even if those duties involve actions that might be considered controversial or questionable.
It's a powerful statement about, you know, respecting the separation of powers and the unique role of the president
you
know, within our system of government. Okay. It's like saying, Mr. President, we trust you to do your job, but...
But we're also not giving you like a free pass here. The court left the door open for future legal challenges based on what happens as a result of the president's actions. Right. So making sure that there's accountability.
So it's a delicate balance between respecting, you know, the president's authority, but also holding him accountable for the results, for the potential consequences of his decision.
Exactly.
It's like they're saying, we're not going to tell you what to do, but we're watching you.
Exactly. Mississippi v. Johnson really highlights how complicated this is, navigating these issues. And it really underscores the importance of judicial restraint, you know? Like, courts shouldn't just jump in and interfere with the president's, you know, execution of his duties.
Right.
They got to be careful about that.
This case truly offers, I think, a fascinating glimpse into, you know, the evolution of how our legal system approaches executive power. And it's remarkable how relevant these principles remain.
Yeah.
You know, even in today's world. I mean, think about all the hot button issues we see where presidential authority is being questioned, immigration, environmental regulations, national security. The echoes of Mississippi v. Johnson are still being felt.
It's a testament to the enduring power of legal precedent. And you know how landmark cases like this continue to shape our understanding of these fundamental constitutional principles. You know, and for anyone listening who's interested in kind of diving deeper into this topic, I'd really recommend checking out later cases like Youngstown Sheet and Tube, which kind of built upon the foundation laid by Mississippi v. Johnson and offers, I think, a more nuanced framework for how to think about and analyze presidential actions.
That's a fantastic suggestion. And, you know, I think it highlights something really important, which is that these cases aren't just, you know, these dusky relics of the past.
Right.
They offer valuable insights into how our government works.
Absolutely.
How we grapple with these, you know, fundamental questions of power and accountability.
They're living documents in a lot of ways. They continue to shape our understanding of the law.
Yeah.
And its impact on society.
Well, on that note, I think we've reached the end of our deep dive. It's been an absolute pleasure exploring this fascinating case with you.
The pleasure is all mine. I always enjoy these deep dives into legal history, especially when they shed light on such important cases.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this journey through legal history. We hope you've gained a deeper understanding of Mississippi v. Johnson and its enduring legacy. And until next time, keep those legal minds sharp and never stop questioning. And always remember, history has a lot to teach us about the law and how it shapes our world.